today, who's a professor at the University, professor of physical geography at the University of Leicester, and she studied at Nottingham and did a PhD in wetland ecology, focusing on the wetlands of the Peak District National Park. And for the last 25 years, she's been working a lot on the ecology, carbon dynamics of peatlands in Southeast Asia, and is really recognised as the leading, I'd say, the leading international authority on this issue in the context of Southeast Asia's peatlands. And she works, as well as the science, she works a lot with a variety of policy stakeholders and NGOs and governments in the context of Malaysia and Indonesia. And in 2013, she was awarded the Busk Medal by the Royal Geographic Society, and in 2015, the Theodore Sperry Award of the Society for Ecological Restoration. So, welcome, Sue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm usually here in Oxford on completely different business, so it's nice to come here on academic business for a change. Right, so, thank you. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my tropical peat swamp story, and I've called it Carbon, Conflict and Compromise, and I will go through each of those three ideas in turn. So, just a little bit to start with, really, which really is, in a sense, also the kind of a story of my presentation. I've been on quite a long research journey. I mean, it's 25 years in Southeast Asia, but obviously it was a while, it was several years after my PhD before I started working out there. And it's been a really interesting research journey. It's had a very large number of unforeseen consequences. Some of them have been very positive, finding out about these wonderful tropical peatland ecosystems and their biodiversity and so on. But also, over those 25 years, I've also seen a huge amount of change in these landscapes. And so part of my talk is going to be about those land use changes, land cover changes, and the carbon consequences of those changes. And something I never realised I was going to encounter 25 years ago was that I was going to be a name that rather a lot of people would know in the region, but probably for all the wrong reasons. So there will also be a little bit in the talk about the conflict. So this is some people being attacked by fresh fruit bunches from oil palm, and that's really where the most of the conflict really has arisen from. So we'll come back to that. And then towards the end, I'm going to go on and say something about how I think we, well, how I hope we can try to bring some of these different stakeholders together. Okay, so let's start off with the carbon. And probably most of the talks that Yadvinda invites are probably talking about carbon above ground. There is carbon above ground in peat swamp forest, but I apologise if I don't mention the above ground carbon very often, because what really matters is the below ground carbon. Because peat swamps are, as their name implies, they're peatlands, they're forests that form on organic soils, and in terms of the below ground, in terms of the soil carbon, they play a really important role in the global carbon cycle. And just to put it into some sort of context, you can see this is a depth-dependent value, but I think that's about 1 meter for the carbon in soil organic matter, shown in the kind of buff colour there. And there we've got our best estimate of how much carbon we've got in peat. So you can see it's sizable, and it does actually exceed the amount of carbon in global vegetation. And of that 650, at least 100 sits in tropical peatlands, 100 billion tonnes. And so if we map that out, most of our peat carbon, most of our peatlands are in the northern hemisphere, but we have significant deposits Southeast Asia, which is where I mainly work. But we've got a new project working in the Congo, and there is also peat in the Amazon basin as well. So up until relatively recently, most of those tropical peat stocks weren't really well known, but we've been fortunate in having some fantastic PhD students who've moved forward our knowledge in both Africa and in South America. So we have these wonderful peatlands. Some of them are still in really pristine condition, and so in those situations, of course, they're operating as a carbon sink. But many peatlands, particularly in the temperate zone and in the tropics, are now subject to really intense human pressures, and this is meaning that they've carbon pools are no longer safe. The carbon is no longer locked up within the peat. It's now being exposed to oxygen as a result of drainage, and that is leading to rapid oxidation of the peat carbon, so released back to the atmosphere, and sometimes that happens very fast indeed where we have peat fires. So I will talk mostly about tropical peatlands, but I think it's really important that we realise when we're talking about vulnerable peat carbon pools that we're no better than some of the countries that we maybe are most focused on in Southeast Asia. So these are all pictures from the UK. So I'm involved in work out in East Anglia, and I'll come back to that. That's vegetable production on peat soils not far from Ely, Cambridge. This is upland peatland in Britain, very, very heavily drained at one point to improve the landscape in terms of stock production, sheep grazing or grouse moor. And of course, this is a view that we had from upland Britain last summer when we had the Saddleworth and the Winter Hill fires. So then transpose that into a tropical situation. Similar situation, drainage for various forms of agricultural land use, and of course peat fires. So I'm going to try and bring some of those ideas back together again towards the end of the talk. If we look at peatlands globally, then we can try to come up with some sort of indication of how much those drained peatlands, which are not all in the tropics, some of them of course are in Europe, we can try to come up with some idea of how much in total those peatlands are emitting in terms of greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere. So we could come up with a number there from the IPCC 2013 assessment. We've then got to add, that's an oxidation loss, so then we've got to add on to that our loss from peat fires. Bit of a guesstimate. We know pretty well for Southeast Asia, but we're not so well, we don't have such good numbers for other parts of the world. And then we can compare those emissions with our total global greenhouse gas emissions from all sources, and we can see that drain peatlands are probably contributing somewhere around about 3% of all global greenhouse gas emissions. So I hope that slide alone gives you some indication of why I bother to work on peatlands and why I bother to try to think about mitigation measures, which we'll come back to. In terms of where the most vulnerable carbon pools are at the present time, then I think we can highlight Southeast Asia, but also Europe. A lot of those drained peatlands, not all of them, but a lot of them, are being used to produce crops, whether it's palm oil down in Southeast Asia or lettuce, as you saw in East Anglia. And here's an interesting paper produced by Kim Carlson a couple of years ago. And she looked at the kind of global distribution of greenhouse gas emissions from crops. And the summation of that work in relation to peatland was that peatlands account for about 32% of cropland greenhouse gas emissions, and yet the peatlands produce only about 1% of the global crop kilocalories. So are we using our peatlands, our drained peatlands, in an appropriate way if we're not really obtaining reasonable return for those greenhouse gas emissions. So, turn back to tropical peatlands. Why are peatlands, particularly tropical peatlands, so vulnerable? Well, we call them land, but in fact they're really water. So in a sense they ought to be peat waterscapes or peat wetscapes or something. They're not really land. And you can see that when you go into one of these peatlands, that it doesn't take much tramping around on the forest floor to create a large puddle. So the water table in an undisturbed peatland is very, very close to or at the peat surface. So this high water table is the regulator of decomposition. So very high water tables will get very low decomposition rates. And of course, it's also the regulator of peat accumulation, carbon accumulation as well. Under natural conditions, these peatlands, wherever they are in the world, exhibit an amazing ability to self-regulate hydrologically. On a tropical peatland, this regulation might be a consequence of the forest itself and the root structures and so on the forest floor, which impede the movement of water across the peat surface. And if they stay wet, of course, then our peat carbon stocks are protected, whether that's from oxidation or combustion. But as soon as we drain them, and we have to drain them if we want to carry out any form of agricultural land use, at least using crops that we have available to us at the current time, then of course we have to put in drainage and we lower the water table. We then allow oxygen to enter the upper part of the peat column, and that means that we have decomposition taking place. And of course in the tropics, because it's permanently moist and permanently warm, that decomposition proceeds all year round and at quite rapid rates. So drying removes all those anaerobic constraints on decomposition, and drying also increases the risk of combustion. So peat is made up of undecomposed plant material, and if that dries, that material will burn. The other reason why peatlands are so vulnerable in Southeast Asia is because of the scale on which that drainage has taken place, that agricultural conversion has taken place. And it's really, really difficult to get your head round the scale. Really, really difficult. Even I find it difficult. I've spent so much time out there. So on this slide here, this is a tiny fraction of a drained peatland landscape in Sumatra, and I've just put some distance bars on it just to give you some idea of what sort of scale we're looking at. And you've then got to imagine that that goes on until you reach the, you reach the horizon. So these are vast landscapes, and in this case we're looking at peat swamp forest. We've got a little bit left there that's been cleared to enable the production of fast growing acacia, which is then used as a fibre source for pulp and paper production. So these landscapes, these huge drained landscapes, sit in the footprint of a huge paper mill. On this slide, of course, it's not acacia, that's palm oil. So, conversion has happened, drainage is happening on a really, really big scale. The other interesting thing about our tropical peats is that they have an extraordinarily high hydraulic conductivity. So as soon as you put in those drains, the water just comes out at an amazing rate of knots, and I think you can get some sort of feel for that from this photograph here of the drainage coming off an oil palm plantation in Sarawak. And you might think, well, that seems sort of counterintuitive, but this is where this self-regulation comes into play. So if you have an undisturbed peat swamp forest, these systems maintain water at the, or very close to the peat surface, despite the fact that these are domed systems. So these are naturally lens-shaped peatland systems. And of course they're very big, so this could be, this could represent 50 kilometres across. But as soon as you put in your drains and you take away your natural vegetation cover, then you've got very, very rapid loss of water from these systems. And actually, for plantation managers, that is an issue, because they then have to try to keep the water on the landscape, because they don't, they need to have, you know, they don't want to overdrain their peatland, because that means the plant roots of the palms or whatever won't be in sufficient contact with the water. And then the third thing to consider is, of course, fire. And fire is used throughout the region. It's in part used as a kind of cheap and effective land clearance tool. But what has happened is that the use of fire has persisted despite the fact that the fire risk of the landscapes in which it's now being used has changed dramatically. So a drained peatland will be at far greater risk of combustion than a peat swamp forest. And so if you continue to use fire in these newly opened up landscapes, then there is a real risk that fire will escape into the wider landscape. But fire continues to be used throughout the region, and I'll come back to that point. So what has happened over the last 25 years or so? Well, when I first started working out there, there really was an awful lot of this category of land cover. So there was a lot of pristine peat swamp forest, and that's nearly all gone now. So in terms of the really... In fact, I would even, you know, not be too certain that, let's at least call that intact, not too damaged. Perhaps pristine is, you know, rather exaggerating. So about 6%, a lot of degraded, so over-logged forests, maybe forests that's impacted by edge effects from plantations. And the biggest land uses now are either large-scale plantations or smallholder farmer areas. And you can see that they make up about 50% of the land use on peatland. In part, yes, 25% or something like that is now occupied by industrial plantations. Partly oil palm, that has undergone a very rapid increase in land area that it occupies, both on mineral soils and on peat soils. And then we have the pulpwood, so that's the red bars at the top. But you can see that doesn't get so much press, at least in this part of the world, but it does occupy quite large areas of land, particularly on Sumatra. And then we have the smallholder sector, which up until recently really has been largely ignored, despite the fact that actually the industrial plantation area and the smallholder area, farming area, is about of equal size. And this is a really burgeoning sector. People are sometimes growing palm oil, but they're also, particularly in the areas not too far from towns and cities, they're producing a range of fruit and vegetables for local markets. And they're using really quite intensive farming techniques, using a lot of fertilisers, using a lot of lime and dolomite, because the problems with these soils are they're acidic and they're very infertile. But they're also using fire, and they're using fire to clear the land, to burn off the crop residues once they've harvested. And any fire like this will burn a small amount of peat as well. In part, the farmers do this because this is a really cheap way of getting some ash fertiliser, rather than buying in inorganic fertilisers, which are more expensive. But you can well see the problem if you've got fire being used in these landscapes and you have an extended dry period, and then is a real chance that these small-scale fires could become uncontrollable fires if they're left unmanaged. So nobody's really looked at the carbon consequences of these types of land management, but we've been fortunate to get some funding. So we've got a joint project with the University of Nottingham, which is working. We've focused on Kalimantan, the island of Borneo, for this work at the moment. So if we sum all of that up, let's exclude fires for the moment. We have high rates of peat oxidation. We have additional greenhouse gases because these are landscapes that have to be quite heavily fertilised. So we've got not only CO2, we've got N2O emissions as well. Depending on where the water table is, these landscapes either function as a very small source for methane or a small sink for methane, at least from the peat surface. Different matter when we look at the drainage channels in these plantations. Those are I haven't put it on the slide actually, but they are a source for methane, and they are also responsible for a flux of dissolved organic carbon as well, which we reckon is about an additional 5% carbon loss on top of the peat oxidation loss. What the fate of all of that organic or fluvial carbon is slowly being elucidated by teams working out in Singapore, for example. Some of it will evade to the atmosphere really quite rapidly from the waterways. Perhaps some of it ends up as long-term burial in sediments. The other thing that we've highlighted in some of our work is that where you have really deep drainage in these plantations, and you look at the age of the carbon that's been washed out from the soil profile, then it's coming from really far down in the peat column. So that's some work that we published a couple of years ago. It is, I have to say, was a very deep drained oil palm plantation. So we repeated that with the student that's working in Sarawak, and for the most part those plantations were being managed with much, much higher water levels, but one location had a lower water table, mean water table throughout the year, and here again we can see that there's a pulse of quite old carbon coming out here, somewhere between 1,000 and 3,000 years old. So the deeper the drainage, the more unstable your carbon stocks will be. So if we put all of that together, again excluding fire emissions, and actually in this case also excluding the fluvial emissions, then we reckon that over the last 25 years we've probably lost, just from oxidation alone, probably about 2,500 million tonnes of carbon. And if you just compare that with stocks, not emissions, then that gives you some idea of the scale of that loss. So that's the UK peat carbon stock, not emission. So fires, I mentioned that. The first really big fires that I encountered were in 97-98, when we had a very strong ENSO coupled with an Indian Ocean dipole event, and that produced an exceptionally long dry season in 97 over into 98. And that was when extensive peat fires happened in Southeast Asia. Of course, it was also linked to the start of really big land clearance activities. So you had the combination of an extended dry season, people using fire in landscapes that were previously fairly low risk of fire, and then you combined that with the with the start of some of the really large-scale land clearance activities. But 97, unfortunately, wasn't unique. There have been significant fires in many other years since, culminating with another really extreme fire year in 2015. And peat fires tend to be smouldering fires. They're burning down into the peat itself, and as a result, they're encountering peat that's quite moist. So they're fires that burn with slowly and with a fairly low oxygen availability. So they, because they're smouldering fires, they're producing, yes, they're producing CO2, but they're also producing reduced compounds such as methane, a whole range, I mean literally a list about as long as your arm, of really unpleasant other things. I just picked out a few things that sounded fairly unpleasant, but the list is really very long indeed. So a whole range of trace gases, with most of which are toxic, carcinogenic and so on. They, all of those emissions, if you like, are in more or less invisible. But what isn't invisible is the small particulates. So you have a sort of smog event with these tiny particles being emitted, which of course people breathe in, causing all sorts of respiratory problems and also cardiac problems as well. These fires are really difficult to extinguish because they're often remote. They can reignite even after rain. And of course, all of these fires have been caused by anthropic ignitions, and there's a very clear link between disturbance, heat and drainage, and fire occurrence. So we know all of that, but controlling them and reducing the incidence of fire is a really complex problem. We also know a lot more than we did in 97 about the emissions and the type of emissions. So I've already mentioned some of these, but just to show you the sort of new knowledge that we can get from, say, for example, the European Space Agency Copernicus project. So this is total aerosol optical depth on the 24th of September 2015 over the region. So you can see what a large part of the region is impacted by fires, which are mostly happening here and over here in Sumatra. And this one is the ammonia emissions. And that's what it looks like on the ground. So when I said those emissions were largely invisible, the soot isn't invisible, but then this time round, 2015, which I've never seen in previous fire years, this is the centre of Plankaraya in Borneo, central Kalimantan, and in 2015 the sky, the air literally turned yellow. So it's clearly some sort of photochemical reactions happening as well. So I suppose it looked even more like some sort of 1950s pea super, or a bit like a sort of photochemical smog in somewhere like LA or Delhi. So really unpleasant, dreadful conditions for people living in the local, in the vicinity of those fires. But, so, you know, you think, look at that picture, you think, okay, we've got to do everything we possibly can to eradicate fire from the landscape. But you go to the landscape and that's what you find. So, you know, when we interview farmers out in these small holding areas, the vast majority are using fire. So this is this is what you might call a wicked problem. And of course they're using fire because they're poor and so on and so forth. Trying to understand the sort of scale of carbon emissions from the fires. This is a bit of a back of an envelope calculation, but it's probably not that far off. Somewhere like 2.9 gigatons of carbon over 25 years, probably somewhat of a similar order of magnitude to the peat oxidation emissions. And if you put those two together, just for Southeast Asia, that means that you've got an average annual emission that's something like 2% of global annual greenhouse gas emissions. And we made the point in one of the papers we produced that we compared our oxidation emissions with our fire emissions and tried to really make this point that peat fires get a lot of publicity, and rightly so, because they cause huge socioeconomic and health burdens on the population. But actually, it's peat oxidation is going on all the time and is of a similar magnitude. And the third thing that happens, if you drain your peatlands, not only do they oxidise, degrade rapidly, not only do they become fire prone, but they also subside. So all of that carbon, all that decomposition, all that combustion, means that you're lowering the peat surface on a constant basis. So this is a new paper that's just come out. It's from this landscape. And we've looked at lots and lots and lots of subsidence data, so basically looking at how the peat surface has moved over time. And we know that our plantations are subsiding, so this is the visible consequence of all that carbon loss, at something like 4 centimetres a year. And we also know that adjacent forest, there's a kind of edge effect, not surprising, these are hydrologically connected landscapes with very high hydraulic conductivities, that there is also at least up to 300 metres, probably more than that, also a drainage impact. So the forest landscape is also going down, which means that we've also got a carbon loss from those forest landscapes abutting onto the plantations. And of course, this doesn't just have a carbon consequence, it also has a socioeconomic consequence, because over time, all of those low-lying peatlands, the surface of those low-lying peatlands, is deflated. And here's some work that was done by Deltares, a hydrological consultancy, looking at one area, the Rajang Delta in Sarawak, 2004, showing the oil palm plantations on peatland, 2009 and 2014, at which point most of the peatlands in the area had been converted to oil palm. If we apply what we know in terms of the rate of subsidence on these landscapes, and we know the height of the landscape, and we know the high water level of the rivers, and we take into account sea level as well, then we can see that over time these landscapes will become flood prone. Of course, initially it will just be perhaps a few weeks in the year when you've got high water levels in your rivers that parts of the plantations will flood, but over a long period of time, now going up to 150 years into the future, all of that landscape will be highly flood prone. So you won't be able to grow oil palm under those conditions. In fact, probably you'll have to stop somewhere around about here, which is about 50 years from now. So these are large plantations. These are large industrial scale plantations, big companies. Perhaps they can afford to eventually take the hit, as it were, although, you know, what the long-term prognosis for those landscapes would be into the future is interesting to speculate. But at much greater risk are the smallholder farmers, because usually they're farming on the shallow peat at the edges of the dome, very close to the rivers or very close to the coast, and they are at greatest risk of flooding as their land subsides. So this was some pictures taken about a year ago, vegetable production being impacted by flooding. Of course, this is not persistent flooding, but for that farmer, that means that crop has been lost, and they'll have to start again when the water levels subside. And this is oil palm. Okay, so moving on from the carbon story to the conflict story. So those of us that work in universities live in dread of the term research impact, because it's something that we've all been encouraged to work hard at so that we can be scored on it in the next research excellence framework. When I started my research, Yapland was probably exactly the same. We'd never heard of research impact. We didn't know anything about it. We just did what we did. and if it had some sort of wider consequences, then that was great, but it wasn't really what we were there to do our research for. So you could interpret research impact in that sense. I'm actually interpreting it in a much more narrow sense, in that I feel like my research has been impacted and is used to create conflict in some sectors, particularly in Southeast Asia. And the reason this has come about was, I didn't see this coming, I didn't intend for this to happen, but some of the outputs from my research has been used to demonstrate that using palm oil as a biofuel will have quite the unintended consequence of possibly converting those biofuels into fuels that have a higher carbon footprint than just using fossil fuels in the first place. And so as a result of that, the EU will bring in a ban on palm oil for biofuels from 2020. It has already been had a similar consequence for the Environmental Protection Agency in the States. And most recently, Norway has announced that it will heavily restrict palm oil in its own country, particularly for biofuels use. So when you trace back a lot of these reports, some of the data that they've used is derived from some of the research that I've been involved in. And so that means that actually, if you say my name to some people in Southeast Asia, they will know it, but they will know it for perhaps the wrong reasons. And so I've had to kind of also cope with these alternative scientific views. These are types of statements that I have have been exposed to on a fairly regular basis, including there is no credible evidence to suggest that Malaysian management of peat soils is contributing to climate change. And of course, often these alternative scientific narratives are supported by socioeconomic and political arguments, and I have no gripe with those, because I know that in some regions of Southeast Asia it is the case that oil palm has provided employment opportunities, secure income, perhaps even a route out of poverty. It's enabled smallholder farmers to have enough money to send their children to school. But sometimes that narrative has become quite fraught, and it has been very much turned against Europe in particular, by quite rightly perhaps, some countries pointing out the possible hypocrisy in foreign NGOs having the gall to criticise Indonesia or Malaysia for their management of peatlands. So that's, if you like, the kind of conflict. I summarise it really, because it's quite complicated, but just a few examples of where I've come into conflict with other people in Southeast Asia, other viewpoints. And so to move on to the compromise, really, because I think this is where I am at the moment. And I'm really trying to kind of bring that diverse expertise, whether it comes from my own perspective or from the alternative perspective, whether that's right or wrong, and try to kind of combine that with what we might call expert understandings to see if we can find some sort of way to bridge the divide. Can we bring these different sides in the debate, if you like, together? And why do I want to do that? Well, it's because I think there is actually a common desire. I'm not using the word sustainable here. I think there is a common desire for responsible peatland management. Increasingly, organisations, big businesses and all the rest of it don't want to be seen to be irresponsible. They want to be seen to doing something responsible. They have corporate social responsibility and all the rest of it. It's also recognising that this is not a a conversation that's just about palm oil and pulpwood, because it could equally be about grouse moors, or it equally could be about lettuce, or it equally could be about the bog fields of Holland or whatever. And it's recognising the need to support livelihoods and economies for landscapes, which now have a lot of people living in. But it's also got to be about recognising that peatland mismanagement is the costs of that are going to be shared regionally and globally. I also want to bust some myths. So this is what I try to do when I'm working with companies. I try to explain. It's rather unfortunate that we have a roundtable on sustainable palm oil. I think if we could start that hot certification scheme again, and I could advise them, I wouldn't get them to use the word sustainable. Because there is no such thing as sustainable management of a drain peatland. Once you put the drainage in, that's it. You're moving in a different direction. There are no easy solutions. Compromises on both sides will be necessary. And equally, there is no kind of protectionist agenda. At least I don't come with a kind of economic protectionist agenda. I'm not using my research to try to protect our rapeseed oil market in Europe, or whatever it is that people sometimes think my agenda is. My agenda is a global climate agenda. And it's informed by work that we do in the UK, where up until very recently, we haven't really grasped the nettle here either. So going back to those drain fen peatlands around Cambridge, we've got leeks being produced. Leeks being produced at the same time that huge carbon emissions are being committed to the atmosphere. And this is what we've done to East Anglia, or Eastern England, the fens, as a result of peat drainage. So the red areas represent remaining blocks of peat where we've got at least 40 centimetres of peat remaining, and the orange areas represent areas that used to be deep peat but which have now lost the peat to a depth, so that in those areas there's less than 40 centimetres of peat remaining. And this is entirely down to drainage-driven oxidation. So we can't claim that we have been the guardians of the peat. But if you take the fens as a parallel with what's happening in Southeast Asia, then of course these are often landscapes that are also supporting large numbers of people and which are producing food. And look at that in terms of food security. So potatoes, not all of that's grown on peat soils, but 24% of the total English acreage of potatoes comes from the fens. So with Brexit possibly round the corner, there are big issues here for food security. So if we decide that this is a landscape that we can no longer afford to manage in this way because we want to reduce our land-based greenhouse gas emissions, then we've got all these issues to grapple with. And, of course, we saw fires as well this summer. And again, those fires are related to peatland drainage. They are related to people being in those landscapes, and they were all started by people, those fires. No natural fires, if you like, lightning strikes. And even if there had been lightning strikes, they're happening in landscapes which are totally human managed landscapes, very heavily drained. So where do we go? Well, we could follow something like the International Peatland Society strategy for responsible peatland management, and that would look something like this. So we would try to conserve our remaining intact peatlands because they're still functioning as a carbon sink, whether it's a blanket bog in Scotland or a peat swamp forest in Southeast Asia. And interestingly, certainly in Indonesia, there is a big role to be played there by private companies, not by the state. The next option is to restore. Not that easy to do. But companies now are, again, mainly driven by the private sector, are interested in restoration in Southeast Asia. And at the same time in Britain, we're also starting to try to re-wet our upland blanket bogs by blocking up the drainage channels that were put into them several decades ago. So I'm working with companies like this big plantation company in Southeast Asia, looking at how we can protect and restore our peat swamp forest ecosystems. And then the next option, the final option, is to mitigate. What can we do in landscapes where we already have economic production? What can we do to mitigate the carbon emissions? Well, the best thing we can do is to try to raise the water level. So we reduce the depth of the oxic peat profile from which the emissions are arising. But that's not going to be easy because particularly in East Anglia, they like to drive big machines almost all the time over these soils. So they can't get onto the soils if they're too wet. Crops might be poorly adapted to higher water tables, so we need to investigate what crops we could develop. And that, of course, particularly in Southeast Asia, might need market development. Increased risk of pathogens, and also I think the danger of raising expectations of what can be actually realistically achieved in peopled landscapes. But going back to the kind of conflict, we would argue that if we don't move forward rapidly, then we will not be in a position to try to slow down those greenhouse gas emissions, which we really desperately need to do. There are some new directions. There are a whole range of national and international initiatives to improve practices on peat soils, particularly in Southeast Asia. Those are just a few of them. And we've done some calculation on what we think that we could achieve if we could raise water levels, not to the surface, not to actually flood these systems, but just to bring the water table up a bit closer to the peat surface. But of course, the challenge will be developing economically viable crops for these high water table conditions. Just want to end on this point, which is really the role of peatlands in meeting the Paris Agreement. So we know that we need to make substantial cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. We should be approaching zero emissions by 2050. In the year 2000, global peatland biome probably shifted from a net sink to a net source of soil-derived greenhouse gas emissions. And if we don't start rehabilitating our peatlands now, re-wetting, restoring, bringing the water table up, then drained peatlands between now and 2050 could absorb something like 10 to 40% of the emission budget for keeping global warming below 1.5 or 2 degrees centigrade. Do we really want to waste, as it were, that portion when we've got far more intractable problems to deal with, transport emissions and so on and so forth? So I would argue that we need to start bringing our drain peatlands back to greenhouse gas neutrality as soon as possible. And in that regard, there clearly is a key role for tropical peatlands. So conserve, restore, mitigate. None of those options are easy. They will all require compromise. Some of them require a great deal of research in terms of new crop varieties and so on. And I think it makes sense to consider our organic soils as finite resources, similar to the way in which we might think about a mineral deposit. We've got to think about more efficient use of that finite resource, but we've got a whole range of economic and social constraints on what we can achieve in terms of reducing emissions. But of course, some urgency about the situation as well. So, if you have been, thank you very much for listening. That's some forestry on peat in Sweden, just to illustrate that whether you're in Sweden or in Sarawak, palm trees on peat, you have the same problems: low bulk density and bent trees. Thank you very much.